Do you have any evidence that completely destroys the nature versus nurture debate? What do we get wrong about this debate?
When I started in psychology 50 years ago, got everything wrong. When I was a graduate student in the early 1970s, you read the textbooks and it's as if you never read the word genetics. I was a psychology undergraduate student. I never once heard the word genetics. And more than that, there was really real antipathy towards genetics. The view was that everything's environmental. You are what you learn. That's such a huge change. I don't know that there's strong evidence on this, but my view is that people are much more accepting of the idea of genetic influence. And that's been one of the most important findings, I think, in psychology, that we've gone from thinking nothing is heritable that is influenced by genetic inherited DNA differences to now realizing everything is heritable. You can't find anything in psychology that's reliably measured that does not show genetic influence. So that's really a remarkable shift. So the first thing that psychologists got wrong is not even thinking genetics wasn't important. It was just not thinking about genetics at all. Then the other side of it's the environment, because I think genetic research has told us more about the environment than a century of environmentalistic research that just assumed everything's environmental. And that research was therefore confounded because they never took into account the fact, yeah, things run in families, but that isn't necessarily because of the environment. We now know things run in families because of genetics. So it's been quite a ride over these 50 years. And what's really cemented all of this is the DNA revolution, which I'm sure we'll get into, because we're no longer talking about twin studies, comparing identical and non-identical twin or adoption studies, but we're talking about DNA itself. So that's been very exciting. I never thought that would happen in my lifetime.
So do you think that's one of the main things that has flipped it from just talking about the environment to now talking a lot about genetics is the breakthroughs in DNA research?
That's probably brought it more to public attention. But from a scientific point of view, I think what's been important is the steady massing of data, all of which points to substantial genetic influence on individual differences in psychological traits. I think it's both of those, but from a scientific point of view, I think the important lesson is you just keep your head down, you keep doing the research, and if the research piles up, eventually people will come around to accept it, even though it was a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people.
Yeah, and why was it such a hard pill to swallow?
The best book on that is 1994 or something by Steven Pinker called The Blank Slate. He reviews the history of it, and some of it's accidental, historical accident. Part of it's the American belief you can be anything you want to be. So there's a lot of reasons why people think more naturally in terms of environment. You see it there. The environment's tangible, whereas you don't see DNA. So I don't know. That's an interesting question that I don't know people have really studied, but it's a good one. Why is it that we are inclined more to think about environment than genetics? And the best thing I can come up with, the word gene wasn't discovered till 100 years ago, whereas environment's always been there. On the other hand, animal breeders for 10,000 years have known that you can breed not just for body, but also for behavior. In fact, behavioral traits were just as important in animal breeding. You think of dogs, for example, and how they became domesticated. Interesting question, Jacob, but I won't fumble more with the answer because I don't really know the answer.
Yeah.
Where are you recording from? Where are you?
I'm in Falmouth, Cornwall.
Oh.
Yeah, where are you?
I'm in Norfolk at the moment. I work in London, but in fact, that's the reason I have to leave in a couple of hours. I go to London from Monday afternoon till Thursday evening.
Oh, so you in Norfolk half the week then?
Yeah, that's where my main house is. I love to sail and swim. I go swimming every morning in the North Sea.
Nice. Like, whereabouts in Norfolk?
Do you know it at all? This is the bit by the closest town is Blakeney.
Blakeney Point?
Yeah, that's where I sail.
Blakeney. Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I'm an avid bird watcher. So, my girlfriend's grandparents live in that area near Holt.
Yeah.
So we've been there.
So we're in Field Darling, which is triangulated from Blakeney to Holt. And it's a great area to be.
a lot of,
it's not Cornwall. It's got its own charm. And
it
especially
does.
If you like birds, because this is a major migratory route, as you no doubt know.
Yeah, yeah. No, small world, isn't it? That's amazing. The thing is with Norfolk as well is it's still got that charm. And is the tourism really heavy in the summer compared to Cornwall? Because I think Cornwall's been a bit over touristy.
Yeah, nothing like Cornwall. Yeah. But there's a lot of tourists in the summer. But what saved this place is that it's really inaccessible by train. You couldn't live up here and commute. You couldn't in Cornwall either.
Yeah.
But it's hard for people to make a living up here. And so they've controlled growth a lot. So it's pretty, it looks, photographs from 100 years ago, and it looks pretty much the same. Certainly on the coast, where you get these beaches like Holcomb Beach, you're probably familiar with. At low tide, it's about a mile wide.
Yeah.
And you won't see a house. So yeah, I love it up here. It's very first place I've ever lived where I feel like this is where I want to be.
How come you chose Norfolk then?
Cherchez la femme. My wife is English. I was in America and she tried living in America. But then we were spending our summers she's from Cambridge. And Cambridge people have places in Norfolk. So she imprinted on Norfolk. And we tried Dorset. Cornwall's a bit too far if you work in London.
Yeah.
But Dorset's possible. It's just so overbuilt. And if you try to commute on weekends, it's impossible. Traffic is so bad. So for that reason, and also because the prices are about 50% that of Dorset and Cornwall.
Yeah, yeah, so, it's crazy. Whereabouts in Dorset?
We looked all around. We tried to stay places because if you like sailing, the Solent is really hard to beat. Sailing up here in Norfolk is very tidal. So like everywhere I sail at high tide, you can almost walk at low tide. It's a big tide and it shelves out for a mile. But that's got its own advantages too. I can be sailing in 15 minutes from my house.
Yeah.
Right? Whereas it's more palaver if you sail big boats and in harbors.
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of where we choose to live, what percentage of that is down to genetics?
Yeah. I don't know that anyone's ever really studied that, but it's an important thing to realize. People think, you know, that where you live is an environmental factor, but actually it's not totally coincidental. I live here because I like the isolation and all of that. And I like having a place in London, but there are some people who they would dread being somewhere where there aren't a lot of people and buzz around, for example. And also I think like seasonal affective disorder, you don't move to England for the weather. That's an important point though. That's this idea of nature of nurture. Even where you live, as you're pointing out, can have some genetic influence. I wouldn't bet that it's very high because a lot of people don't have much choice over where they live. But when you're given a choice, I think if you're smart, you listen to your genes in a way and say, no, I just like this sort of place rather than that sort of place, rather than being persuaded on the basis of what's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. And I've noticed this thing where a lot of people in Cornwall have come from London. And is that what we're talking about here, where now they have the choice, they've maybe got a bit more wealth. They're like, okay, I grew up in this bustling, busy area. I want the complete opposite for me. And then when I speak to people from Cornwall, they're like, oh, I want to go to uni in London. Why is that happening?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe part of that's a developmental phenomenon rather than a genetic one. I find a lot of people, I grew up and I spent first 40 years of my life in America. Mm. And I would never think about going back to America.
Really?
Yeah. A lot of young people here, it's still the dream for them.
Yeah.
America is so exciting and everything. Whereas I spend a lot of time in New York and I do find London, I prefer London much more than New York. But I think that's developmental. And there's also grass is greener on the other side of the fence, isn't it?
Outside of the pond. Yeah. So why do you prefer London to New York?
For lots of reasons. I was just in India last week and the bustle there drives me nuts a little bit. And people think London's bustling, but it's not like New York. And also, even geographically, New York is divided. It was planned rationally. Avenues go north and south, streets go east and west. It's this grid-like thing. Whereas in London, you can't walk 100 yards and be on the same street. You're always leading into another street. architecturally, it's so interesting. In America, an old building, that building's 100 years old, and that's a big deal.
Yeah.
I don't know. The one advantage New York has is it never closes, as people say. You can go out and get sushi at 4 in the morning, but at my age, that isn't very appealing anyway.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Just in general, I like London. I find people friendlier, and there's a certain suspicion and almost hostility in New York. You smile at a stranger and they're backing away from you.
Yeah, yeah. And am I correct in saying, did you grow up in Chicago, at least study in Chicago? Yeah, and you mentioned the American dream and how it could be flipped upside down due to the findings on genetics. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's disheartening for people when you say, it's not true that you can be anything you want to be. You can try hard and you can move in that direction, but take anything, athletics or musical ability, for example. If you work really hard at those things, you can do a lot better. But then if you look around and you see there are other people who with hardly any training, you know, they've just so far ahead of you. And if you want to just get into the enjoyment of sports and music, fine. But if you want to be a competitive musician or athlete, you really need the genetic goods in addition to a lot of hard work. Although Trump proves anyone can be president. But other than that, I think it's important to know our strengths and weaknesses and to realize that there are genetic factors behind that. Doesn't mean you can't change these things, but why not listen to genetics and go with the flow rather than fighting upstream? I always want to emphasize it's not deterministic, but you might as well go with your strengths and minimize your weakness. If you're not a very sociable person, you probably wouldn't want to go into a job that requires a lot of glad-handing and that sort of thing. So that's another long topic, but a good question.
It's really interesting. And do you think the ability to follow your intellectual and, I guess, genetic abilities is, again, a genetic trait? Do you think the ability to understand what your strengths and weaknesses are down to genetics as well? Because I feel like I've been so far pretty decent at figuring out what I want to do versus what society tries to maybe push you to do. So a lot of the time at school, we were pushed to do STEM, like science, technology, engineering, maths. But I was like, I want to do photography. And there was no photography classes in my school, but I did it in my own time. And I was interested, like we were talking about, with birds and wildlife. So I was like, I'll become a wildlife photographer. But then I also am interested in a lot of different conversations and topics and like having deep conversations with people. That's why I started the show. Do you think that's heritable? And do you think that's to do with disagreeableness in some ways?
Yeah. Another interesting question about which we have no research to my knowledge, but the first law of behavioral genetics is everything is heritable. So if you could measure that tendency you're talking about, which might be somewhat related to the personality trait of openness to experience, curiosity. But if you could measure it reliably, I'd be willing to bet a lot of money it would show genetic influence. It won't be 100% heritable, but there'll be a strong genetic component to it. So that's another good question about which we don't really have a solid answer.
And how do we determine the percentage of environment and heritability when we're like looking at specific traits?
Yeah. So you just mentioned the word heritability, and that six-syllable word is probably the most misunderstood word in biology. What it refers to is individual differences. Why are some people taller than others? And most people would accept, we've done studies on this, they would say, yeah, it's very substantially heritable. We know what we mean by that. It runs in families for genetic reasons. So that's such a strong effect. It's maybe 80% heritable. Now, the way we get to that percentage, it's the extent to which inherited DNA differences account for differences we observe, say in height or behavior. But just taking height as an example, it's not about, if we say it's 80% heritable, it doesn't mean you grew to your height 80% because of genes and 20% because of environment. It means the differences between people are due to inherited DNA differences. And the way we get at that is through two major methods, the twin study and the adoption study. The simplest method involves identical twins. So if you have identical twins reared apart, so they didn't grow up in correlated environments, you find that they're about 0.8 similar for height. In fact, they're just as similar for height as identical twins reared together. So growing, you could say maybe height. There are some people who think height is due to nutrition and all of that. And it is true. If you starve a kid or something, they're not going to grow up to the height that their genetic trajectory would have suggested. But what we're saying is that these identical twins reared apart don't share environments, so that their similarity is due to their inherited DNA differences. Identical twins are clones of one another. They're genetically identical. So that 0.8 correlation between identical twins reared apart for height, we could talk about the statistics behind it, but what it means is 80% of the differences between people in height are due to inherited DNA differences. If instead, if you found identical twins reared apart correlate zero for height because they weren't reared in the same environment, that would suggest a heritability of zero. So what we find for all, so that's the simplest version of the twin study, but the one that's used much more often because there aren't a lot of identical twins reared apart is the twin method, which compares identical twins to the other type of twin, which is called non-identical fraternal twins. They're like any brother and sister, 50% similar genetically. But for height, you find identical twins are about correlate about 0.8. Fraternal twins correlate for height about 0.4. Now, fraternal twins share 50% of their genes. So the difference between the identical and the non-identical twin correlation, 0.4, is an estimate of half of the genetic influence. So if you double that, you get back to the 0.8,
yeah,
is 80% of the differences are inherited. And then the other major method is the adoption method. And really, identical twins reared apart is an adoption method. Twin method is a biological experiment. There are these two types of twins, both of which grow up in the same womb at the same time. But one type of twin, 100% similar genetically. The other is 50% similar genetically. The adoption method is a social experiment in which you take genetically related people who normally share environments, but you separate them at birth so that they don't share environments, they only share genes. And what you find there is that the correlation for siblings or twins adopted apart is just the same as for twins reared together. That is, growing up in the same family, nurture, which is what we thought was always so important, doesn't have any effect. What makes you similar is your genetics. The environment's important, but this is the second major method from behavioral genetics. That first thing is everything's heritable. Second, nothing's heritable 100%. But what you don't explain with inheritance, you explain by environment, but it's not the environment we thought was important. It's not nurture. It's not growing up in a family with somebody, which is what all of the environmentalism from Freud onward was about. It's perfectly reasonable. You think growing up in a family is the most important, rudimentary sort of environmental influence on children's development. But it turns out it's not true. And that's still very hard for people to accept. So that's something we might get into a bit more, but I'll just put a marker in that for now.
Yeah. What is it then?
Yeah.
It's not family.
Yeah. It's something else. And for 30 years, people have been trying to figure out what else it could be. What is it that could make two kids in the same family different from one another? You could say maybe differential parenting. Maybe parents treat one kid differently from another. That's been studied, doesn't account for much. And parents don't treat kids that differently.
Yeah.
We often. So that's not a very good hypothesis. And then it could be Judith Harris wrote a famous book called The Nurture Assumption about 20 years ago. And she was saying, maybe it's peers. We haven't studied peers. You and, I don't know if you have siblings, do you?
Yeah, two.
Yeah. One of the first, okay. And so people then studied peers and your siblings, you and your siblings probably have different friends.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it could be that has an influence on you. And that's been studied, doesn't seem to have a systematic effect. People have gone down the list. A big one might be accidents, maybe illnesses in childhood. That accounts for some anecdotal cases, but as a systematic effect, I didn't seem to come up with much. So after 30 years of research coming up empty-handed, trying to answer the question you raise, if it's not family environment, what is it? I'm actually working on this now, is considering the possibility that most environmental effects are random, or even more than that, stochastic. So random is the idea. Yeah. So random is the idea that it's unsystematic, unpredictable.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's true. But do you know Robert Sapolsky wrote a book last year called Determined? We can get into that. But a lot of scientists think every effect has to be caused by something. So yeah, something does make identical twins different from one another. But maybe there's many tiny environmental factors that maybe are so small we can't measure them. Mm. Idiosyncratic. But I'm beginning to think it's even more worse than that. I think it might be stochastic in the sense that it's completely non-deterministic. That is, if you could go back and measure every atom and know everything about what happened to you, and you replayed the tape, I'm saying you'd probably get a different result.
Wow.
And there's a lot of interest in that in science as a whole. The idea of that's stochastic. So it's more than unpredictable. It means you replay the tape and you get a different result. And so in biology, it comes out as the noise from complexity of biological systems, for example. It's a big deal in physics too, from quantum mechanics all the way out to cosmology. There's an interest in this. And there's books written about it in terms of economics. Maybe a lot of that is unpredictable. And sports, that has a major impact. I'm interested in it too, because it's a default explanation. People keep thinking, there's got to be something else out there we haven't measured. But after 30 years, you got to start saying, maybe it's not predictable. It's caused by something, certainly. But if you can't measure it, then it's essentially stochastic. Or at least unpredictable. And I think it has neat implications in life. Instead of assuming that you have control over things, I think you got to realize that shit happens. There's a lot of chance out there. And I think clinically, instead of trying to fix people's problems as if once, okay, you get them back on the right path and everything's okay, I think we need to think about helping people to be resilient with the inevitable chance factors that happen. And so I think it's a kind of an important notion that, but so I was just in Bhutan. I went to India and then Bhutan for the last week, and they really live a Buddhist sort of life, not totally spiritual, but an impermanence is a very big part of that mindfulness. And that's what we're talking about here. What appears disappears. And that's really what enlightenment is about in some ways, is recognizing that all there is now and things change. And so it's important to be attuned to that so that when something bad happens, you don't fall apart. You're more stoic about it.
And yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah.
Do what you can with what you've got and realize it's going to happen. This stuff will happen. You'll get ill and definitely you'll get old. I don't know. It's a big, fun topic to work on, and I'm working on it with some very bright people. And even after being in Bhutan, I'm bringing some Buddhist philosophers into it too. It's some very cool people in Buddhism who are not just airy-fairy mindfulness people. These are like top-notch mathematicians and physicists. And so it's a lot of fun to think about the answer to your question. If it's not family environment, what is it? And I wasn't just being flippant when I said it's something else.
Yeah. Does this exceed the realms of science if we can't measure and predict it? And is that why you're almost, not necessarily consciously doing it, but it could be a reason why you're getting these Buddhists involved? Is it more spiritual? Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
I'm an empiricist, so I would want empirical approaches to this. And one way we've approached it is to say, try and find factor X. What are these factors that make a difference? And there's still some possibilities that if you measure the microenvironment, which you could do with real-time recording now and with stuffy wearables, technology, it's possible, but I'm dubious that it's going to lead to predictable influences, because that's what's important to me. But that's a negative, isn't it? If you think those things are important, find them, show me, great. I'd love to find out what the answer to your question is, what makes, say, identical twins different. But I think there are ways in which we can study stochasticity. So we might not be able to predict, but as a scientist, you want to understand. And there's some cool ways of doing it, things that haven't been thought about before, like even DNA. As you go through life, you build up spontaneous mutations.
Yeah.
And those are different for members of an identical twin pair. So that, by my definition, is a source of these, what we call non-shared environment. It's the generic term given to these environmental factors that make kids in a family different from one another, not similar. So that somatic mutations are one example of a biological factor that you could study. You couldn't predict a somatic mutation because they're random.
Yeah.
But it's cool to study that. And there are other examples, like in cognitive psychology, there's a current sort of theory is that randomness is an important part of cognition. And it has to do with, I don't know if Anil Seth and his wonderful book called...
I'm interviewing him soon, I think, hopefully.
Oh, really? He's fantastic, and he'll talk to you about this. See, he talks about perception as controlled hallucinations, that it's the Buddhist thing again, that you think you're seeing me, but all you're seeing are photons, and your mind is creating this image of me. It's not real. You're not seeing me. In fact, if you were an atomic microscope, you wouldn't, all you'd see is a bunch of space. I'm mostly space. I'm not. So it's a neat idea, controlled hallucination. And his thing is about the idea of controlled hallucination is that we're creating these images and it's done in predictive processing. And that's where this idea of perception, that randomness being an important part of it. You're forming hypotheses about things. And to form those hypotheses about, is this a bear coming at me? You make initial perceptions, but then you sample from this domain. And so the more you sample from, the more likely it is you're going to reach the correct functional conclusion. So anyway, there's so much interesting stuff here. And I'm interested in the idea of the general idea that things are less determined than we think. It's the opposite of Sapolsky's book, that there's a lot of chance out there. And not all of it is just noise. Some of it serves a function. And that especially interests me.
And in terms of the environment stuff, like you're saying, it's stochastic. And could it be like just millions of micro inputs from our environment that we're just reacting to that all add up? But because there's so many and they're so small right now, it's very hard to measure and see.
And maybe not right now, maybe forever.
Yeah.
Because the difference is on genetics, it's an interesting parallel that we used to think of genetic influence, find the gene, find maybe a few genes. But what we know now is heritability is due to thousands, tens of thousands of tiny DNA effects. But we can add those up because we know the human genome. The 3 billion base pairs of DNA is all we inherit. So it's a hugely complex issue, but we can actually add up these little effects and come up with a score that we call a polygenic score that is your risk for, say, schizophrenia. And it's predictive completely because your DNA at conception is all you've got in terms of inherited DNA differences. And so those differences in the first cell with which you began life, those are the DNA differences we're talking about predicting your risk for schizophrenia now as an adult. So contrast that to the environment. Okay, maybe there's thousands, hundreds of thousands of tiny environmental factors, but we don't have a DNA code for the environment. We can't add these things up because they're not limited in any way. So it's a much harder task to study what some people have called the environome, like genome. So I think that's an interesting parallel that in a way, genetics is easy. The environment is hard.
We used to think it was the other way around, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. And so are you saying about the sequencing and the polygenetics, we can get our entire individual, I don't know if this is the right terminology, but like genome sequence to find out what diseases we might be susceptible to and things like that. Can anyone do that right now?
Yeah. I bet a lot of your audience have done things like 23andMe or Ancestry.com. And they're not, up until recently, like the last few years, they don't sequence all 3 billion base pairs of DNA. They sample DNA differences throughout the genome, say 600,000 is typical. So they're just sampling your DNA differences, but it's a long technical story, but you can get a pretty good index of your risk for these genetic factors. And that's what a lot of these direct-to-consumer DNA companies are about, is predicting things like your risk for schizophrenia, your ability, say, educational achievement is one of the most predictive polygenic scores we have right now.
Wow.
Today, you can predict almost 20% of the variance, that is, of the differences between kids in their GCSE scores on the basis of DNA alone, knowing nothing else about a kid. And that's only 20%. And you might be surprised to know GCSE scores are about 60% heritable. That means in the differences in kids in their GCSE scores for non-English listeners, these are scores that kids take at usually at the age of 16 at the end of secondary school. And it's very deterministic of whether they go on to university and that sort of thing. So they're a big deal. But they are about 60% heritable, which surprises a lot of people. We call it achievement because we think it's due to your effort. And effort is part of it. You've got to work, certainly. But a big fact is 60% of the variance is due to inherited DNA differences. And it's not 100%. And 20% that you can predict with DNA today is a long way from 60%. But still, people don't understand effect size. 20% of the variance explaining that is a monster effect that, as compared to most other findings in psychology, that rarely explain 5% of the variance. This isn't 5%, 15%, 50%, it's 60% of the variance. So explaining 20% of the variance is huge. And I just put a marker in there for effect size. When people say, talk about an effect, if parents do X, kids are Y, just always ask how much of the variance is explained by it. Because often these findings in psychology explain a tiny amount of variance. They don't matter in the real world. You can't see them. But here we're talking about big effects, and make the point about effect size in this context, because people say it's only 20% of the variance. So what's a great example of effect size in England and GCSE scores is that people spend a lot of money to send their kids to the best schools so that they can get a leg up in terms of the educational system. And so about 5 years ago, so I was asking, how much of the variance in GCSE scores is explained by school quality? And we have these Ofsted ratings, the best in the world in terms of quality of schools. And that's what creates league tables, where parents spend a lot of money, sometimes to move to the other side of the street, so they're in the catchment area for a better school. And so we've got all those data. How much of the variance in GCSE scores is explained by school quality? And the answer is 4%.
Wow.
And if you correct for socioeconomic status, because kids aren't randomly assigned to schools, 1%. So people are turning their lives upside down for 1% of the variance, whereas they ignore what we can predict now, 20% of the variance. So this is just to underline that a lot of stuff in science is statistically significant, but not very socially significant. And this is big. These are bigger findings, bigger effect sizes by far than anything we see in psychology. So it pays to pay attention to it, I guess, is my bottom line there.
Yeah. And what conclusion should parents and students draw from that on a fundamental level?
It makes this genetic influence seem much more concrete. That's one thing. This is real. We can actually predict to some extent. Now, it makes a difference within families, for example. Siblings are 50% similar genetically. That means they're 50% different genetically. And so what you find is the range of differences between people, between siblings, is really very big. And an example I use in the book Blueprint is that my sister and I were always very different. I read early. We didn't have any books in our house, but I went to the library and I was just a voracious reader. I loved school partly because I found it so easy. In contrast, my sister was slow to read and just didn't like school. She wasn't very good at it. And of course, in the environmentalistic times, people assume she's lazy or my parents messed up with her. It must be environmental. But it's important to know that siblings in a family differ a lot. Now, that's not to say that my parents shouldn't push my sister to do well at school, but I don't deserve credit for doing well at school, and she doesn't deserve blame for doing poorly at school. And maybe if parents realized that not everyone is made, it's hard for university-educated parents to accept this, but not everyone is made to go to university. In fact, I'm not sure we need more PhDs. I think what we need are plumbers and carers and people who can do practical stuff.
Yeah.
But we don't value that because we have this one golden yardstick of academic achievement. And I think that's a mistake. We need to capitalize on our social capital isn't just intellectual ability, but it's a much broader base than that. So that's one implication for people. But it's still hard to accept that one of your children might not be as academically oriented as another. But it is true, and it's better to deal with it than to try to force everyone into one mold. Because that's the larger message of genetics, to recognize individual differences and to respect them. So it doesn't mean at school you just give up on the kids who are slow to learn. It really means you put more energy into them. It's called the Finnish model of education. The kids at the high end, you're not going to stop them from learning to read. Or if they're good at math with the internet now and these online programs, they're going to go as fast and far as they want. And that's great. But it actually frees you up then to make sure that you spend the resources needed to bring everybody up to some minimal level of literacy and numeracy so that they can survive in this increasingly technological world of ours. But you don't think you're going to make everyone into an academic superstar. And I don't think we want to do that anyway.
Yeah. And how can your findings and what we're talking about actually explain these outliers or perceived outliers where they come from this horrible background or this tough childhood and somehow exceed all perceived expectations on them? The famous people in history that had gone through a lot of things, or even people like Hitler or Stalin, which came from relatively low socioeconomic status and then somehow became these really obviously evil but powerful men. How can we explain that?
Yeah, another good question. It's something that interests me a lot because one of the applications for me of these polygenic scores, and this is, I've put in 3 grant proposals for this, and the science is good, but people are worried about the ethical side of this. But if you take kids in England from the lowest SES background, most disadvantaged sort of background, the range of polygenic scores for educational achievement is very large. It overlaps a lot with the distribution for kids from the best socioeconomic status. And that's what genetics is about. It's these mixture. So on average, the kids from the worst environments will have lower polygenic scores than the kids from the best environments because it's not just environmental. When we talk about socioeconomic status, the biggest factor there is educational attainment. So there's strong genetic influence on this. But we're talking now not just about the mean difference, it's the variation, this normal distribution. And the kids from the worst disadvantaged environments can have great genetic potential, but it's wasted largely because they're in environments that just keep pushing them down. They don't have the role models or whatever. So I'm interested in the, say, social capital, the intellectual capital that's being wasted by these kids who have really great genetic potential, but their environment is such that they're never going to be able to exploit it. And so you could use DNA to identify these kids and give them a leg up in life. And so that partly answers your question, though, because you expect that kids from the high, it goes the other way. You take kids from the most highly talented parents, and there's this thing called regression to the mean. On average, yeah, they're going to be, say, if the average IQ of PhDs is 130. So people probably know IQ is just standardized, mean of 100, standard deviation of 15. So two standard deviations above the mean, an IQ of 130 is about 2-4% of the population. So parents with an average IQ of 130 have kids not with an IQ of 130, but because it's about 50% heritable, their average IQ will be more like 120, 115, something like that. It'll regress to the mean. But again, there's a huge variation around that. Some kids from parents who are very high IQ will have quite low IQs. This is expected on the basis of how genetics works. Some of them will have IQs even higher than their parents. So it works at both ends, but I'm particularly interested at the lower end because the kids at the higher end probably have most of the advantages anyway, and they'll do about as good as they can do. But we could really make a difference at the lower end in terms of identifying kids who have this talent, and it's largely being wasted. Because I grew up in inner city Chicago, and I saw a lot of that too. In tougher schools, and I think in Britain now, schools are generally okay. They're not terrible places to be. But when I was growing up in these poorer environments, like in inner city Chicago, you had to really hide your talent under a basket or you'd be beaten up because you can't be seen to be doing well at school. So you have to do it on the sly in a way. So that's the sort of thing I'd like to help younger people with who come from socially disadvantaged environments.
How would you?
Long-winded answer to your question. But.
No, it's all good. And how would you identify these kids? Would it be through just sampling their DNA?
Yeah. The neat thing about it is if you do direct-to-consumer testing, especially if you do whole genome sequencing, you only do that once. And with that, you can get hundreds of polygenic scores that predict behavior. And now the NHS, several countries like Finland and Estonia for several years, every time you go in the hospital and get blood, they say, do you want us to do the DNA testing? And then NHS is now has a $50 million project to try this out. But eventually, and sooner, I think, rather than later, all newborns are going to be sequenced, which will get us into the Gattaca business. You know that 1997 film?
No, I don't.
Oh, people should really watch it because it was a really prescient film. In 1997, before the human genome was sequenced, this film predicted everything that could happen, like prenatal testing. And that's what happens now. That's the hot thing right now with IVF. And Elon Musk has apparently been using that to select embryos, where he's got 14 kids now.
Yeah.
So that's in vitro fertilization. But then even before that, a hot thing a few years ago on the DNA direct-to-consumer testing companies was DNA dating, saying they could match you to someone else. And then postnatal testing is what Gattaca is really about. If you didn't have the genetic goods, it limited what you could do in life. And the story of Gattaca is this guy wanted, Ethan Hawke, no less, wanted to be an astronaut. But it showed at birth that he had a very high risk for a major heart attack early in life. And the subtitle of the film is There's No Gene for the Human Spirit. And so the film shows that he managed to fake the whole system and use Jude Law's DNA, who was a crippled athlete, but who had excellent DNA. Mm. He faked his DNA with Jude Law's DNA. So he managed to get into this aeronautic school called Gattaca, which are the four letters of the DNA code, G-A-T-N-C. And so the end of the film is him taking off in a spaceship that he succeeded despite the odds. But actually, if you think about it in a minute, what about him having a heart attack on that trip and endangering his colleagues?
Yeah.
And then also, why would he want to, again, why not go with the flow? He had a lot of other talents. Why did he have to pretend not to have heart problems when he did have heart problems? So it raises a lot of issues. The thing about Gattaca, though, is it got all these things right about DNA identification. That was another thing. It's been very useful in getting supposed murderers off of death row in America because they had a DNA sample. And now we can say that DNA that you say was the murderer's DNA is not this guy's DNA. Mm. So all those things were predicted by Gattaca. But the theme of the movie is that there's a totalitarian government that forces this down everybody's throat. And so it can say bad DNA. Genetics has always had is the bad guy and the environment's the good guy. But I think pretty much it's the other way around. Our environmentalism led to mother blaming. When I was in graduate school, it was really thought that schizophrenia is an environmental disorder caused by what your parents did to you in the first few years of life.
We still learn about the schizophrenogenic mother in psychology. That was 2 years ago.
It's such bullshit. There's absolutely no truth to that. No empirical evidence for it. And yet what that meant was basically mother blaming. And you would, as a parent, wouldn't find out schizophrenia doesn't develop till the late teens or early 20s. And then you're told it's because of what you did in the first few years of life. How wicked is that?
Mm.
Especially because it's totally not true. Yeah. So mother blaming. So the environment isn't the guy with the white hat necessarily. I think there's a lot of evil that's been done in terms of environmentalism. And genetics doesn't wear the black hat. We can predict problems and prevent them before they occur. And if you think of, well, people say Nazi Germany right away, eugenics. Mm. But actually, many more people, at least as many people, were killed by Stalin,
yeah,
by Mao,
yeah,
and in North Korea. And people don't quite realize those are environmentalistic theories. They don't accept genetic differences between people. In the Soviet Union, it was everybody's the same. Infants are animals, but we then enculturate them and we make them be what we want them to be, good little citizens. So environmentalism has done much worse damage, I think, than genetics could do. And the big difference is genetics is true and environmentalism is false. So a lot there. But anyway, I do recommend Gattaca to people, but to realize that the main message is really wrong. It's not that you get the totalitarian government forcing you to do genetics. What's clearly true, it's consumer-led. People want to know this information. They want to know if Uncle Harry dies of a heart attack, am I at high genetic risk for having a heart attack? Because if you are, there are things you can do to prevent it. Even low-tech things, just pay attention to the message we all get, eat, exercise, that sort of thing. But you can go higher tech than that. You can get whole body scans. You can predict furry arteries before they actually start to obstruct your blood flow. So medicine has moved totally, really moving away from the idea of waiting until a disorder happens, and then trying to cure it, which we're not all that good at. You have a severe heart attack. Yeah, we can patch you up. But your quality of life is not going to be the same as it was before. So prevention, Benjamin Franklin was right, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's the way medicine's moving. And to prevent, you have to predict. And DNA is the best predictor around because it doesn't change from the moment of conception. So you can predict early. And what we know is most interventions that work they work better the earlier you intervene. And more intensively as well. Cheap little tricks don't usually do it. And so all of that means you need to identify the people who are at greatest risk and then intervene early and try to prevent these problems from happening. So there's a lot there, I know, but the main thing there was I mentioned Gattaca, and it was prescient in predicting all the uses of DNA in society, but it got the overall message totally wrong, that it's not going to be forced on our throats. The way it's taking over is that it's consumer-led. People want this information. Yeah. So that's cool. And the other film I'll mention is Three Identical Strangers. Have you seen that? It won the, forgot the name of it, the Robert Redford Film Festival. Anyway, it won an award for a documentary. And it's about identical twins, but actually identical triplets who had been separated at birth. And so the story is about them finding each other when they were about 19 years old, and just by accident. And it was like looking at yourself in the mirror. These guys were so identical, and they didn't know about the existence of the other ones. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say triplets is that it's usually one fertilized egg splits in the first few days of life, and they're identical twins. They have the same DNA. And once in a great while, one of those also splits. So you actually get identical triplets.
Wow.
And that's what it was in this case. And it's a very powerful film because it's amazing how similar they are, not just in looks and height and body structure, but also behaviorally, personality and that sort of thing. One of the bits I like especially is that they were the type of student I like. They're intelligent, read, but they just don't like school. They don't like the strictures of school. Like you, they say, do STEM, and you say, I want to do photography. And so once they got together, they dropped out of university and they went to Manhattan. They were real social characters, and they set up a nightclub called Triplets, and it made $1 million in the first year.
Wow.
So it's a great example. But again, genetics is bad, environment's good. It ends up being a negative story about genetics because, and rightfully, you might ask, why were these three identical twins obviously born at the same time in the same hospital? How is it possible? They were separated for 20 years of their life and didn't even know about the existence of the other. And enter a wicked psychiatrist who thought this would be the perfect nature-nurture experiment. And he believed in nurture. So he put one in kind of the lowest SES environment. He adopted it into that family. One in one of the wealthiest families in Long Island. And then one in a middle-class family with a high school teacher. And he thought this was going to be proof positive. It's all nurture. And in fact, you look at it and it's all nature. And so he never published it as a result of this. But eventually he was caught out that he was the one doing it. And there are several other pairs of twins that he separated in this same sort of misguided experiment in the late 50s, before there were ethical review boards and that sort of thing. So he was the psychiatrist for this adoption agency in Brooklyn. And that's how he had the power to do this. So again, it ends up, though, looking like a dark story about genetics. But the first half of the film is what I'm talking about. How impressive it is that even with separated identical twins, how similar they are. So,
is that based on a true story?
Yeah. Oh, no, it's not. It's definitely a documentary film. Totally.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
But did it happen before, like in real life, the triplet thing?
There are hundreds of pairs of identical twins. There's a famous study in Minnesota that brought together identical twins reared apart throughout the world. And many of them didn't know about the existence of the other. Mm. Those are the most interesting ones. And the story after story, the famous Jim twins, where they're just amazingly different. Probably the most striking one was Oscar and someone else, where they were born in Germany, Nazi Germany. One was raised in a kibbutz in Israel, and the other was raised in one of these Nazi escape families that escaped to Africa, South America. So as different as they could be, yet they get together, and it's just three identical strangers. When they first meet, it's like they've known each other all their life.
Wow. They're
rolling around on the floor, playing like brothers. They are. It's amazing to see. So there's lots of twins like this. We, in Sweden, we studied about 150 pairs of identical twins reared apart, as well as fraternal twins. And That was because in Sweden in the early 1900s, there was economic depression. It was a very agrarian society back then, and there were crop failures, and so people were desperate. So if you were a farmer, your wife dies in during delivery, you got these two kids, and you say, does anyone want them? And usually they get separated then, but they do have good records in Sweden, so you could go back. And what we did is we traced where they are, and so we brought together a lot of these pairs of twins that didn't know about the existence of the others. So it isn't just the few anecdotal pairs. There are hundreds of pairs that have been studied. And what they show is that identical twins reared apart for most psychological traits are almost as similar as identical twins reared together. Wow. So that's the easiest sort of way in which people can understand the power of genetics.
Is it when they come back together, are they directly interested in the same thing? Like they follow the same sport? Or is it like, oh, we're both interested in sport, or we're both have this introverted personality type? How specific are the similarities?
That's the amazing thing, is that it seems to be very specific. Like these gym twins I mentioned, they're both firemen, but what their hobby is not just carpentry, but it's creating circular benches around trees.
Really?
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You'd think that cannot be genetic. Maybe it's just an anecdote. It's so idiosyncratic. You won't find how many people in the world do that, even do carpentry, let alone carpentry that involves building benches that encircle trees. And the Minnesota study has been criticized for noting that another pair of twins, they name their dogs the same. They use the same tooth, a very exotic brand of toothpaste, for example. And you can imagine that there is a lot of genetics involved in your taste preferences, maybe, but it's so anecdotal. And what you worry about is if you and I went to Minnesota and were tested as identical twins reared apart, they test them for a week and collect something like 50,000 pieces of information. There'd be some amazing similarities between you and me, even though mostly not identical twins.
Yeah, true.
There is that issue. And that's why these larger studies like we did in Sweden are important, because there you get good quantitative data. It isn't just anecdotes. The famous aphorism that, data is not the plural of anecdote? Something like that. You know what I mean? That an anecdote isn't data.
And so in the Swedish studies, how often did they have similar jobs or the same job?
Yeah, we never got down to that level of detail, so I can't really answer that question. We were studying more of the traditional traits of personality, psychopathology, cognitive abilities. But in support of what you're saying is there's three books, probably more now, written about these studies of identical twins reared apart. And one of the things they want to address is, what do the twins notice about each other when they first get together? And it's amazing to me that invariably, it's none of the things we study. They don't say, oh, we're very similar in intelligence, or we both have the same sort of memory skills, or our personalities are very similar. They notice those things later, but the first thing they notice is something we hardly ever study, and that's nonverbal communication. They notice things like the way they laugh. Some people are very different in the way they laugh, how open they are, expressive or whatever. And in Minnesota, a cool thing they did is they brought a comedian in and they had split screens. They had the twins in different rooms and they're responding to this comedian. And it's just amazing. You'd swear it's Photoshop and it's the same person on both sides of the screen, but it wasn't. So that's amazing. But then the other aspects of nonverbal communication, they almost always mention. It's just they notice how they sit, how they stand, how often they use their hands when they're talking. And it's interesting to me that you'd think that's too specific to be genetic, but maybe not. Because what we know from animal breeding is there are like 17 breeds of sheepdogs, all of which are bred for very specific aspects of herding, for example. You can breed for very specific behaviors. That's another area that interests me a lot, is how can it be so specific like that?
Yeah. What does that indicate about parenting? Does this mean great parenting is largely irrelevant and parents are wasting their time worrying about how much influence they have on their kids?
Well, another great question. The 7 pages in my book, Blueprint on Parenting, got more attention than anything else, because the title of that section parents matter, but they don't make a difference.
Mm.
So parents matter. Kids can't grow up without caretakers.
Yeah. And
parents provide an important part. It's the longest lifelong relationship we have. And so it's a very important part of kids' lives, but I don't believe they make a difference environmentally. Most of what happens is genetic, and the environment is not the systematic effects of parenting that we always thought they were. Now, a bunch of things to say at the same time there. It doesn't mean that parents don't matter. They do matter. They, as Judith Harris said in her book, Nurture Assumption, they have the power to make kids' lives miserable. The other side of it is that if parents think kids are a blob of clay, they mold to be what they want them to be, they really should read my book and get over it, because it's just not true. And that's good. If their kid is 1% of the population gets diagnosed as schizophrenic.
Hmm.
And if your kid becomes schizophrenic, you know, and you think it's what you did in the first few years of life, that is really difficult to live with. So you need to recognize you can't really take credit for what your kids do well, and you can't take the blame for what doesn't work out so well. So I think it's a really revolutionary way of thinking about genetics. And there's something, if you go on Amazon and just click on, ask for parenting books, I think there's something like over 10,000 books on parenting. How many of them mention genetics? Zero.
Wow.
I think the single most important thing for parents to know about parenting is genetics. A lot of what your kid's going to be is going to be determined genetically. It doesn't mean you can't make a difference. If you're determined that your kid's going to be a marathon runner, you can train your kid, make them much better at it. But unless they've got the genetic goods, they're never going to be a competitive marathon runner. You're going to set yourself up and your kid up for failure. So much better for parents to think about giving their kids opportunities to find out what they like to do,
yeah,
and what they're good at. It seems obvious, but and part of that's genetic. And I think there's a lot here to know about parenting, but the main message is with your younger listeners that when they become parents, they really need to hear that genetics is a large part of what's going on. And the difference they make is pretty limited. Now, they can control a kid's behavior. It doesn't mean to say, you say, oh, nothing I can do. You just let the kids run wild. No, if your kid, one kid's hitting the other kid over the head, you don't allow that to happen. But you're not going to change the kid's personality or their psychopathology or their cognitive ability very much. And you got to learn to live with that and help the kid develop their strengths, minimize weaknesses. An example I often use is shyness. It's one of the most heritable aspects of personality in childhood. And in America, being shy is pathological. If you ever sat to next to an American on an airplane, they'll tell you their whole life story.
Yeah.
So if you had a kid who's shy and you ask parents, why is your kid shy? They always give you one of two environmental answers. Because I took her out too much when she was young, or I didn't take her out enough when she was young, which exposes what's wrong with environmental theories. Mm-hmm. After the fact, you can explain anything environmentally.
Mm.
It's not true. It's mostly genetic. It's highly heritable. And so what do you do if you have a kid who's very shy? You recognize it's not pathological. There's just a range of variation there. And so if your kid's shy, they're going to a birthday party where there's a lot of kids they don't know. That's what's tough if you're shy. After you get to know people, there's no such thing as shyness because you're familiar with them. So you wouldn't just dump your kid off at the party and say, see you in 3 hours. You would probably have them go with another friend, or you might go in and just get them acclimated to it. It's just common sense in a way, but it begins by recognizing these differences and respecting them to a greater extent.
And what does this say about how much we can change over time? Because I would say I was relatively shy kid when I didn't know people. I was like an introvert, but then I was also one of the most popular people in school when I was in primary school. That's what parents have told me. I can't remember all of it, obviously. And now when I'm older, I see myself becoming a bit more confident and extroverted. How can that be explained? Because I still think I'm naturally an introvert, so maybe I'm always going to be the same in that regard.
Yeah.
But How does confidence play into this in terms of genetics and environment?
Yeah, I think that's a very good example of what I'm talking about, that if you are genetically shy, it doesn't mean you can't do these things.
Yeah.
But when you get older, get into the idea of going with the flow for yourself too.
Yeah.
You know, like, I never like cocktail parties. People say, what? I mean, it's what they love most, meeting a whole bunch of interesting people they don't know. I like talking to people one-on-one.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I don't like going to a party.
Yeah.
So as you get older, you say, I could do it. If I had a job that required that I go and glad hand a bunch of people, I can do it. But I'm at a point where I say, why? I don't like doing that. I haven't got that much time left. I want to do stuff I like to do. I like to meet people, but one-on-one. I don't like social bullshit or the sort of stuff you get we have to shout in someone's ear. When you can't have a real conversation. So I don't understand why people like it, but it's partly because I am, like you, I'm a bit shy, which in the English sense is almost good. It's like a little reticence or whatever. I think that's a very good example. Recognizing your genetic propensity is good, but then also realizing you can say, despite that shyness, I have to go and meet these people. And when you just get yourself set up for it and you say, I can do it. So that confidence, I think, is important. But you don't want to forget, you don't want to assume that mask you're putting on is you. I don't think that's helpful. Mm-hmm. Or to think that's the good you.
Yeah.
You know, you are you. And part of understanding ourselves is genetic. And we don't give that enough credit. We think understanding ourselves, if you go to a shrink, is understanding what your parents did to you in the first few years of life. That really is what a lot of it's about.
Yeah. And attachment theory and stuff like that. I was going to ask you that, actually. How attachment theory and genetics, what is your stance on attachment theory? How we can have these insecure, avoidant, resistant, and secure attachments apparently based on our parents and our like primary caregiver.
Yep.
What's your stance?
Well, I think those are good. Those are descriptions of parent-child relationships. And they're probably reasonably good descriptors of that relationship. In fact, you can think about it as your romantic relationships. You could probably describe them in that way as well. So it's a description of a relationship. The problem is people assume from Freud onwards, that's what determines your mental health in life. And there's no evidence for that. And it bothers me now, a lot of younger people they assume that everything that's wrong with them is caused by what their parents did in the first few years of life.
Yeah.
Part of understanding yourself is to realize it's not true. Mm. And a lot of people don't want to hear that. Because it's just easier to blame everything on your parents. But it's not good to be wrong. And it's better to say, no, there's just these individual differences. And it doesn't mean you're doomed for life, but probably understanding yourself and say, no, I have a tendency towards, say, I'm an optimist, but say if I had a tendency towards depression, it's probably worthwhile recognizing that. Mm-hmm. Maybe hanging out with people, organizing your environment so you don't ruminate, you don't get stuck in these do loops of dread. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot of advantage in understanding that ourselves, not in terms of what our parents did to us in the first few years of life, but to say, maybe that's who I am.
Yeah.
And B.F. Skinner, the famous behaviorist, he was the ultimate environmentalist, raising his kid in a cage, basically completely controlling the environment. The kid became screwed up, but he really thought and believed that it was all environmental. But then later in life, he wrote a book on old age. And in it, he said, the older I become, the more I become who I am, which is what I was saying.
Yeah.
You just say, fuck it. I'm shy and I don't care. I'm not going to go to parties and pretend that I love it because I don't. Yeah. So I'm not going to go. So I think it's a good point that as we get older, we recognize more of who we are. Our life is less determined by social norms or fads and that sort of thing. What's cool or not.
Yeah. It's funny how you're saying about the party thing, because in terms of groups, I was thinking, I think I'm not that shy anymore. But then as soon as you mentioned group settings, I was like, oh my God, if I was in a group scenario where you have to shout in people's ear, I have done it, but I've just sat in the corner and just stared at them because I just don't enjoy it.
What I do is I pick some one person out.
Yeah, or do that. That's probably better.
You go somewhere where you can talk.
Yeah. I find myself often in those scenarios getting dragging myself outside, usually, just because it's easier to do that, isn't it? And it's funny that you were mentioning the individual differences. It's because I remember my mum always says jokingly how my dad would want to go to a social place with his art friends. And then he used to want my mum to go, but my mum was just like, no, I'm not going. I just want to stay at home and read. And they've both accepted that now. It's just funny how the individual differences really reflect in social settings, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And how can that be a good thing? How can people who are young, maybe my age, because you're saying as you've got older, you've been more attuned with your strengths and your preferences. How can we accept who we are in a good way and try and reject maybe pressures from external societies, especially if you're especially if you're susceptible to being agreeable, but maybe you should accept you're agreeable. So it's maybe a bit of a paradox in a way for those kind of people.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. But if you think about it in terms of what I said with your kids, you got to recognize that there are differences and help them experience different things and help them find the things they like to do and to make it possible for them to do that. We can do that with ourselves too, to some extent. We use our heads. I'm just surprised. Academia, there's a lot of very bright people. I'm amazed at how little they use their intelligence for their day-to-day life. And say, when you do that, things go wrong. Don't you pay attention to that and say, maybe that isn't the right thing for me to do. So I do think we could apply these same sorts of principles to understanding ourselves to a greater extent and perhaps being more accepting of ourselves. Rather than setting up these ideals and this is probably what makes a lot of kids depressed with social media now is that Facebook and everything, it looks like people are leading these golden lives where everything is totally wonderful. Mm. And then you say, oh, my life is shit by comparison. Mm. But I guess the message there is just to think more about who we are, understanding ourselves. And again, meditation and that sort of thing is useful for people to just slow down all the noise and chatter and think about your experience. And I won't go into a whole meditation session here, but there's a lot of very good online meditation things. I meditate every morning just for 10 minutes. First thing in the morning, just gets my day going right. And just cut down on the chatter and just think about the moment and things like being grateful for all that's good in our lives. Rather than thinking about, on Facebook, these guys look like they're having a tremendous time. They're always on holiday and that sort of thing. So I think we need to use our intelligence more to understand ourselves and to think about what we're doing in life.
And when you say meditate, is it guided or are you just closing your eyes and focusing on your breath?
Yeah, no, it's guided definitely for me. And I know a lot of people feel that they don't want someone guiding them in it. And maybe if you get far enough along, that's good. I've been doing it for 3 years now. And I started with Sam Harris.
Yeah.
He has that Waking Up app, which is a great title because that's what it's about. It's waking up. It's the thing we were saying about Anil Seth that you'll be hearing about in one of your future interviews, that just to realize that it's all hallucination. This is the Matrix, really. And you got to take the red pill.
Yeah.
And wake up. That's why his app's called Waking Up. His is quite guided, but the one I'm doing in the last year or so is Henry Shookman, which is called The Path. And Sam Harris is a neuroscientist. And so he has a lot of science. It's great resources on his website, Waking Up, for interviews with top Buddhist teachers and that sort of thing. But it's almost overwhelming the amount of information you have. Whereas the one I'm doing now, Henry Shookman, it's called The Path because it's totally the opposite. It's completely sequential. It takes you through in 10-minute segments forever along the path to awakening, basically. And I find that better for me just because I don't have to think in the morning. I just say, okay, continue. Minute session. But there's a lot of apps out there, but these are the two that I've found best and can't recommend it enough to people. And I'm not an airy-fairy sort of person on this. It's just such a great way to start the day. And we need help through the chaos of life. And everyone talks about things are going faster and you can't keep up with stuff. And it's good to just slow down and do things mindfully is really what it's all about.
And how come you're doing that in the morning? How do you feel after doing that in the morning? Because when I think of, I need to actually try it myself, but when I think of meditating first thing in the morning, I'd feel like I'm maybe a bit more tired. But does it just calm you and actually give you a weird sense of energy?
I think there's definitely the latter for me. But again, there's big individual differences.
Yeah.
And they're the one people talk about. There are no typologies, but we do talk about night owls and people who rise early. And I've always been a very early riser. I get up early in the morning. I wake up and I'm zinging. I'm totally wide awake. Oh, too much so. That's why mindfulness is good, because when I wake up, I've got hundreds of thoughts buzzing, but it's chatter more.
Mm.
Oh, got to do this. Oh, I forgot to do that. That sort of stuff. And so that's why for me, it's very useful to just slow down, get centered, and then decide what I'm going to do and do it mindfully, whatever it is I have to do. Whereas I think are you a night owl?
No, I was going to say this because when I was, maybe we could quickly talk about this. When I was a teenager in lockdown, as soon as school was gone, I was a night owl. It was like 3 a.m., 6 a.m. And then I thought through my own free will, I think I've become more of a morning person, and I have to put an alarm on normally. So I'm like 6 to 8 a.m. normally wake up. I prefer if I have the same alarm every day at 6 a.m. because it makes me feel good about myself. But I don't know if it's forced in some regards, but I wouldn't say I'm a night owl now.
Yeah. I think it's important to recognize that some people really do think better at night. But I definitely think better in the morning. I get up at 3 or 4 in the morning and I do all my work before I go to work.
Yeah.
The only rule is I can't do anything in the morning that I have to do. Mm. It's a good rule. I just think I work on big projects like the stochasticity. And then during the day, I just do all the crap you have to do. Not crap, just stuff.
Yeah.
Administrative stuff. And you got to mark papers and teach classes and stuff. I do teaching too. But so for me, it definitely works better in the morning. But I recognize there really are differences. And it's not to say you can't change it, although it would be really hard for me to become a night owl because by 10 o'clock, I'm dead because I only sleep for 5 hours or so.
Really? Wow. No naps either.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm a big napper. I believe in.
Yeah.
Every 2 hours, I would take a 10-minute nap if I was on a regular sort of schedule. But then the big difference is there. Some people say, if I take a nap, I'm dead. But for me, I can take a 10-minute nap, no alarms or anything. And
really? Wow.
I wake up and I'm completely energized for another couple of hours. So
How long did it take you to find that out? Has that been natural for you? Or is it, again, as you got older, you've tapped into that more?
I think it's a bit of both. But again, it's genetic, I think. In my family, we never slept past 7 in the morning. Mm. New Year's Eve, you stay up late at night. It was almost like puritanical. It's really wasteful to sleep past 7 in the morning.
I do feel that as well. Yeah. And
if that's not your tendency, though, you might be being less effective rather than recognizing, I just do work better at night. I've certainly known people who they're just no good in the morning. A long time to wake up and get going.
Yeah. So if there's one action the audience should take from this conversation, what should it be?
I've been thinking it's another topic to raise, but it's, I think, probably the most important thing for me right now. And that's about DNA testing. Mm. It's limited as to how much you can predict about yourself, but it's going to happen medically and then psychological will follow because it's this, once you get your genome sequenced or DNA tested, you can use that information to create polygenic scores for anything. Okay, so it's interesting to do and it will be done medically. So in the NHS now, when they ask you if you want your DNA tested, there's a project now called Our Future Health that's trying to get 5 million people to contribute their DNA. Because in England, we have this wonderful NHS system, Britain, that has national health records, which, you know, isn't true, and it's certainly not true in the States. So it's a great, you need large samples to pick up these smaller effects. So they will only provide information if it's actionable. But right now, the NHS is piloting another project where they've always tested neonates at newborns for just a handful of single gene genetic disorders. But now they've expanded it to 200 actionable things. And it'll eventually go to polygenic scores. And so it'll get into the Gattaca thing where you could say this kid is going to be at high risk for, say, having a major heart attack early in life. But you could say that's a downer. But actually, you can prevent those things.
Yep, exactly.
So why would you not want to do that? Okay, so this is all happening. And you get useful information. Most people do DNA testing for ancestry. Because it's very interesting. All the Americans think they're Irish or Scottish or something. And
they're never English. They're never English, though, are they? They never say they're English or Welsh.
That's true, actually. Yes. Yeah, that's really true. Why do they want to be Irish? Anyway, we won't go there. But what I wanted to say is that a new thing that's happening is DNA testing of single gene disorders. Now, most of those are recessive, meaning you need two copies of them. So there's, say, 7,000, 10,000 single gene recessive disorders. So we're all carriers for several of these, meaning we have one copy, but we don't show anything because we need two copies.
Yeah.
I assume your readers would know, your listeners would know about recessive and dominant.
Yeah.
So the thing about it is that you will only have affected kids if two carriers mate. And if they mate, they'll have a 25% chance of having affected offspring. If you could not just determine at birth whether they have this, but you could do this before they have children, you could in one generation almost eliminate these single gene recessive disorders.
Mm.
So there's a company I'm connected to, no financial involvement, but they're focusing on this right now. And if you did DNA testing with them, you get a free DNA testing for a person you're thinking about having children with.
Wow.
And so then they would screen for these disorders, because right now, the way people find out they're carriers is they have a kid who's affected.
Yeah.
And these are mostly bad things, like Tay-Sachs, for example, in Ashkenazi Jews. It's kids start out normal, and then they just decline, and they die in early childhood. These are horrible diseases. This isn't a neurodiversity issue. These are things nobody would wish on a child. And so if you found out you and your potential mate were both carriers for this disorder, you do have some options. You have lots of options. You could decide it's not worth having kids. You could, this many fish in the sea, you could go back and try again.
Yeah.
Or you could have in vitro fertilization. And that's the other big thing now, is once you have a kid who has a disorder, if you have more kids, almost everybody would want to do in vitro fertilization to avoid implanting an embryo that has a double dose of these recessive disorders. But I think if you do it, in vitro is a big deal. In the States, the Elon Musk premier in vitro fertilization, where you're selecting embryos and all of that, is maybe $50,000 a crack or something. But if couples did this and they found out, okay, you and your spouse you're not both carriers. You're carriers for a lot of these diseases, but you're not carriers for the same disease, no problem. And that's mostly what you would find out. But maybe 5, 10% of the time you'd find out, no, you are carriers for the same disorder. And they started this with Tay-Sachs in New York with Ashkenazi Jews 10 years ago or so. And they already do arrange marriages and they screen couples. It's not just romantic love. And one, instead of in the States, you got to be tested for sexual transmitted diseases. That's blood. And if you can use that blood to do DNA testing,
yeah,
they decided to do that a long time ago in New York. testing specifically for this one gene mutation called that leads to Tay-Sachs disease, and they pretty much eliminated Tay-Sachs disease at no cost. It's not like you get a baby, find out that they have Tay-Sachs, and you try to do some dramatic sort of medical treatment. There's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
So it seems to me a no-brainer, and I think that might be the most important thing that young people could consider. Why not? The cost isn't great. It's amusing. You find out about your ancestry. Find out about the stupid single gene things like, does your pee smell after you eat asparagus? Or there are a lot of these quirky little single gene things. But then there are some bigger ones like alcoholism, major mental disorders, especially schizophrenia. So I'd really recommend that people think about the DNA testing.
How much is it?
Most of the companies, it's on the order of $100.
Is that it?
Yeah. That's not for whole genome sequencing, but that's only $400 or $500. And as I say, this company I'm involved with, they offer they're so keen on doing the couples thing that if you did it, you would have a free go for someone you're thinking about having a kid with. And I would say, why not? Why would you not want to do that? So again, we don't want to go Gattaca and totalitarian governments demanding that you do this. The way they demand that you get screened for sexually transmitted diseases if you're going to marry someone, at least in the States. But it should be consumer-led. And once people understand what we've been talking about, you'd say, why would you not want to do this? So that's the one message we didn't get to that I thought was important to put a plug in for.
100%. And what's the company you're involved with called, where you get the free one for your partner?
Yeah, it's called Nucleus of the Cell Genomics.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'll leave that in the show notes for people to check out. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're a good company. And the reason I've been a scientific advisor to them is because they have science people there who are doing really good work. And it's a wild west. There's, last count, I counted 50 of these direct-to-consumer DNA companies. And mostly the information they give you is crap. There's no regulation whatsoever. It really pisses me off because with very little effort, they could give people good information. They can't be bothered, really. They just want your DNA because it's a big data thing. Whereas this company, they're good scientists and they're providing good information to people. And a lot of it is in the interpretation. What does it mean if you're at the 80th percentile of risk for schizophrenia? You might say, oh, that's very bad. Only 1% of the population becomes diagnosed. So there's lots of stories there, Jacob, but I don't want to push this one company too much. As I say, I have no financial involvement with them.
Yeah, so good.
But I know there's a lot of bad companies out there, and I know this one's a good one. So I would recommend people check it out. And you can do the sampling of DNA differences I talked about, but you could also do the whole genome sequencing. And what's cool about that is once you've done it, that's all she wrote.
Yeah.
And so forevermore now, if anything comes up, you would have your DNA and you could say, is that me or not?
So will they give you then a summary of this means that and that means this?
Absolutely. And that's what I also like about them, is they do a really good job at helping people to understand the effect size of a particular polygenic score and how you can interpret your results. Because it isn't simple. People have trouble understanding even single gene disorders. Mm. What does it mean to have a 60? There's a one gene called apolipoprotein E, which if you have this rare form of it, in a recessive, again, double dose, you have a 60%, 70% chance of having Alzheimer's later in life.
Wow.
Now, it's not so wow because later in life, maybe 15% of the population will have dementia. But still, medical terms, 60% versus 15% is huge. And what was my point with that? I lost my train of thought there. Sorry.
I guess like we were saying about the heart disease thing as well, once you're aware of it, it doesn't mean you're going to get it, but if you know that you have a higher chance of getting it, you can do the preventative measures to reduce the likelihood of that happening, which is why I'm actually now confused about the fact that we don't do the DNA testing and sampling or the genome sequencing for newborns straight away. Because I've had a few blood tests and I'm, as far as I'm aware, they haven't done a sequence or a sample on me.
You never would have, no.
Yeah.
It's all too new, I think.
Yeah.
But I can guarantee it will happen. And as I say, it'll happen medically. And I don't know if this wasn't my point with the Alzheimer's thing, but when I give a public lecture, I often use that as an example of, would you want to know? And if you ask a public audience, it splits right down the middle. 50% say, no, I wouldn't want to know. It would ruin my life to know that I'm going to have Alzheimer's, or I have a very high risk of having Alzheimer's later in life. The other half, like me, would say, knowledge is power. I want to know everything. And you could say, although there's no treatment for Alzheimer's yet, once we're able to predict, you're not going to learn about Alzheimer's from Alzheimer's patients. You've got to, all of this is oriented towards prevention. Once someone's brain, you don't need a microscope to see there's something drastically wrong in a post-mortem of a brain that had Alzheimer's. To do anything about it, you've got to be able to predict and prevent these problems early. And we can't do that until we can predict. So we will eventually be able to ameliorate, at least, and or delay the onset of Alzheimer's. That's what a lot of this is going for. Because it's thought if we all lived long enough into our hundreds, almost everyone would have Alzheimer's. They'd have dementia. It's amazing the brain, the most complex organ in the world, exists as long as it does. Into the that at, in the 70s, I can still talk. I can still think. That's totally amazing from an evolutionary perspective in a way. But even now in the public audience, I would say you can't prevent it right now or ameliorate it. But if you knew you were at a high risk of having Alzheimer's later in life, you could do something about it. You could set yourself up socially and economically to realize you've got to deal with that situation. And I would also say, more carpe diem, you'd say, don't wait until I'm in my 70s to do all the things I wanted to do.
Yeah.
Instead to say, no, I really have to think about all this traveling I want to do or learning music or stuff. I can't put it off to when I retire. So there's a lot here, but I just wanted to leave at least the younger listeners with this thought that, a new thought, nobody talks about this, but the idea of doing DNA testing, not just for yourself, but also for someone you're planning to have kids with.
Yeah, super important. And hopefully that becomes commonplace in the next few years or decades. And as a final question, if you could give your 20-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be and why? Not 20-year-olds today, but 20-year-old, your 20-year-old self.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's a tough one for me because I couldn't say do genetic testing. Because I don't have regrets. I think I was always independent, and to be in genetics then, which was almost a taboo subject, you had to have a thick skin and you had to feel like, no, I'm doing good work here, doing good science. Keep your head down. And I didn't respond to critics very much because they don't have anything better to do. Whereas I had research I wanted to do, and it proved right in the long run. I always said that in the long run, I hope students in the future, which is maybe people like you now, would say, what's all the fuss about? Surely genetics is important. It's not all or even at all nurture. That's a cop-out because it sounds arrogant to say, I think I did all right.
No, that's good.
Yeah, I feel like I led my life and I don't have regrets about what happened. And I think I was very lucky. I got into genetics just as it was starting to happen, while it was still controversial. As I say, I never thought the DNA revolution would come along in my lifetime. And that's partly why I can't quit, because it's just so exciting what's going on in the field. You can't keep up with the literature. It's got to be the most exciting part of science, biological science anyway, these days. Thanks very much for talking to me about this stuff. And I hope if people in your audience have questions, I'm easy to find. Just Google Robert Plowman. I don't hide. I don't do social media, though. I find it not good for my mental health. But I do email, so I'm easy to contact on email.
Awesome. I'll leave all the information, your website and stuff, in the show notes below. Robert Plomin, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me. This has been really insightful. And
great. Yeah. Thanks so much, Jacob.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Right.
If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.